ahead and pick the speed up. Your number one now, runway 27, clear to land green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello and welcome to the Green Dot, EAA's podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. I'm one of your hosts, Hal Bryan, EAA's managing editor for print and digital content and publications. Joining me as a co-host, it is...
I'm Chris Henry, the EAA museum manager.
And Chris, we're quite fortunate to be hosting one of our own today in the studio.
Yeah, it's fun. It's something we don't always do, which is sort of turn the camera, although we don't have a camera, in on ourselves. Today we are very lucky to have Jim Buscia. Jim, you are one of our vice presidents here, and you cover a multitude of areas. What are you the vice president of exactly? What all do you have under your umbrella?
So I am currently the vice president of publications, membership, marketing, retail, and facilities.
Wow. And what do you do in your spare time?
Well, I write books.
That's awesome.
Great segue.
Well, and you actually are here because you wrote a book, which we're going to talk about here in a minute. You've written several books, but you're here for one specific one that we're talking about. And an honor is a hero that you don't, you fly, it's a type of role, an aircraft that he flew that isn't one you see a lot of movies made about or a lot of books made about. And really excited to talk about that here in just a minute. But before we roll into that, let's talk about you for a second. Tell us a little bit about how you got interested in aviation.
Well, obviously living in the city that holds the world's largest aviation event every year, I've been coming to this convention since 1970, so I would have been very, very young. I snuck under the fence. And I always used to joke later on with Paul Poberesny, the founder of EAA, that I still owed him $10 for doing that. But obviously a big part of it. I was always enamored with the World War II veterans, especially the pilots, the aviation side of it. And even younger days when, you know, as a child, you were forced to go to the library on summer vacation and always, you know, pick up a book. I always gravitated towards the World War II history books, like the Mighty 8th Air Force and things like that. So building models and eventually learning to fly when I was about 18 years old.
Oh, wow. Can you tell me a little bit about learning to fly? Who did you fly with? What did you learn in?
So, ironically, my first instructor was a very deaf former B-17 pilot who flew all of his missions out of England for the 8th Air Force. And we learned in a Cessna 150. And here at Oshkosh is where I learned to fly.
So, Jim, you went on from there. Your first career was in law enforcement, 30 years of service here in Oshkosh, for which we thank you. And alongside that, though, you maintained an involvement and an interest in aviation and writing and things like that. You eventually went on to own, well, now two L-Birds of your own. What have you owned and flown?
So even when I had my career in law enforcement, my partner and I were able to convince our chief that we needed an aviation unit, and we flew a Quicksilver GT500 for several years, and I'd land in schoolyards and the Target parking lot, and, you know, we'd do for DARE instruction, and also we used it for searching. You know, we have a lot of large bodies of water and a lot of farm fields around here, so lost people and unfortunately deceased people. But eventually I bought my own L-Bird in 2000, an Aronca L3, and that was built in 1943, and it was stationed during the war in South Dakota, where it taught B-17 radio operators.
So, and then from there, you did eventually sell the L3, and you've got a different L-Bird now.
Yes, I did sell the L3, and I had that for 18 years. It was a great aircraft, but I bought a Project Stinson L5 that Sam Tabor and Tab Air down in East Troy, Wisconsin, restored in 2016 when it first flew, and I've had that ever since. And then Over the weekend, I just purchased another aircraft.
Well, congratulations.
Oh, wow. Well, congratulations in advance.
Why don't you tell us what that is, even though I think I could make a pretty good guess over here.
So I've been enamored with the Fairchild PT series, and I purchased a freshly restored Fairchild PT-19 from Mike Kelly in Michigan, who has been restoring Fairchilds probably longer than I've been alive. And he and I struck a deal over 2 years ago. So I've been following this project and boring hell with the updates on a weekly basis. But so hopefully it will be, fingers crossed, here at AirVenture.
Well, I've been hanging on every word of those, and you know it. And so congratulations on crossing that that threshold. I know it's been a long time coming.
Oh, that's super cool. Well, we want to talk and transition into a little bit of the story that we're here to talk about today. So tell us a little bit about how did you get into writing? What was sort of your first entry into that, and what interested you the most about getting into that?
Even in high school, I was horrible in math, but I gravitated towards English. For some reason, I really like the writing aspect of that. And obviously that carried through in my law enforcement career, where I wrote hundreds and over thousands of police reports. But I still was enamored with the history part of aviation. So I was convinced by Sam Tabor again to interview a World War II veteran who ran the Guinea short lines in New Guinea during World War II. And they used Stinson L5s and Stinson L1s to land in very, very remote jungle strips. Some had to be hacked out of the jungle, but very, very short strips to rescue downed airmen. And they were very successful in that role, and they carried a little kangaroo as their monif on their culling.
I imagine if you were a downed airman, that was probably the most beautiful airplane you could see coming for you as a ride out of there.
Definitely, definitely. So I wrote a story about Frank Bartlett, the commander of that group, and I sent it to Flight Journal magazine, knowing full well that I would be receiving a pink slip in the mail saying it's rejected. Ironically, I received an email from the editor, Bud Davison, long-term writer. He's been to almost every AirVenture and even every EAA convention since it was in Rockford. And Bud said, "I'll take it. How many more you have?" And then that sent me on a journey to try to interview as many veterans as I could before they had gone west.
So, Jim, over the years, that passion for interviewing those veterans, it led you to amass a remarkable library of oral histories, and you've been able to build on those and create a number of books. How many books have you written, if we count this latest one about Bazooka Charlie?
So, book-wise, this is my fifth one. Interviews, I've done over 350 interviews of World War II veterans, and very honored to do that. The books I have written are not my books. They're the veterans' books. My name is on there. I put their words together, but it's not my book. I want to make that clear that these are the veteran stories, and I had told Chris earlier that early on when I started interviewing veterans, I'd always end the interview with, boy, I wish I would have interviewed you 20 years ago. And my interview started in around 1999, and the veteran would pause and he would say, "I wouldn't have told you what I did 20 years ago. The reason I'm telling you this now is because I want my grandchildren to know what I did during the war." And they would explain that as a veteran, they just did their jobs and they were no heroes, even though I was interviewing Medal of Honor recipients, famous aces, but they would not claim themselves as heroes. The heroes, they said, were the ones that were left behind that didn't make it back.
And that's so poignant now that we are rapidly approaching the point where there simply won't be any more World War II veterans around, just by virtue of time passing and longevity. And there's something, at the risk of being sort of melodramatic, there's something, Jim, almost providential about you being inspired to do that at just the time you did. As you have said, if you'd started earlier, they wouldn't have been talking. If you, the later you started, the fewer you would have been able to talk to. So what a treasure and what a resource that is, not only for your books, but informing stories in all of our publications. And certainly you're kind enough to share a lot of that information with me when we do stories in Warbirds magazine and those comparisons and things like that. So it's a profound collection and a terrific contribution that you've made to capturing those histories.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a good take on something I never thought of, that they just have to be to a point where they're ready to talk about it and or they want to get it preserved. And I think we're seeing that, you know, probably right now with our Vietnam veterans, they're finally ready to start sharing a little bit about their time over there, some more than others. But it's that time for them right now, it feels like, you know, that their stories are starting to kind of shake loose, if you will. But yeah, absolutely. So the story we're here to talk about today revolves around what I would call a not typical hero of World War II. It's not an airplane that you would think you'd see. You know, you hear B-17s and P-51s and things like that in World War II, but we're going to talk basically about a Cub. And some of the work that these guys did. Can you tell us a little bit about the book and the research and what it's about?
Yeah, so let's get to the title of the book, because I'm sure people are chomping at the bit. You keep talking about a book.
I want you to.
They're saying, what is this book title?
We leave them wanting more, Jim.
Yes.
So the book that Chris is referring to is Bazooka Charlie, The Incredible Story of Major Charles Carpenter and Rosie the Rocketeer. And Rosie is his L4 Cub, but Major Carpenter was born in 1912 in a rural farm setting near Moline, Illinois, near the banks of the muddy waters of the Mississippi River, was one of six children. Unfortunately, by the time he was six or seven, his father, who had two vices, probably some of the worst vices you could have, drinking and gambling, and they didn't dance well together. His father actually bet his 1,000-acre farm, and he lost. And Charles's mother eventually divorced him and had to move in with her mother with her brood of six children. And they were penniless. And this was the roaring 20s. But the only thing roaring was their stomachs, because they had no food at that time. So it was a difficult time for the Carpenter family. But I think it also helped instill and built in him that there was no sense of failure, that he would overcome any obstacle thrown at him. And I think it really proves it from his letters that he wrote. He was a prolific writer, a voracious reader. He was described as a Renaissance man and also a philosopher. So by the time he was 17, he had written his own creed, basically saying that he would be a better man. He would do good for this world, and set out on that course. He eventually joined the civilian training corps, where you had to go to a four-week school for 4 years in a row, and he eventually was commissioned a second lieutenant in the Army Reserve.
Now, he was not the only one in his family, or not the only one of his siblings to serve, correct?
Correct. His younger brother, Gene, Eventually became an Army Air Corps. At the time, it was called the Army Air Corps. He became a pursuit pilot and was eventually stationed at a place called Clark Field in the Philippines. And we'll get to that in a minute. But Charles, during the Depression era, when there were no jobs available, attended the Roosevelt Military Academy. And then eventually went to a college in Kentucky where he earned a degree. And after he earned his degree, he stated he was going to change the world, and he became a teacher. He became a history teacher in Moline, and that's where he met the love of his life at a local dance named Elda, and where he nicknamed her Bunny. And they eventually married, and then their lives were disrupted on December 7th, 1941.
Well, and I think like so many Americans, I mean, and really, you know, the world, December 7th changed the route, the trajectory of everybody's lives. But it had a pretty big impact on the Carpenter family. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what happened to his brother and what happened to him then at that point?
So obviously, like many Americans at the time, following the attack on December 7th, they all would gather around their radios and listen to President Roosevelt's speech and what was to come. But they also had in the back of their mind that their brother Gene was stationed at Clark Field in the Philippines. And ironically, one of the last letters received home was dated December 5th, 1941, where Gene stated to his mother, "Don't worry about us. The Japanese would never, ever try to rub Uncle Sam's hair. Don't worry about that. And we have more military might here than they have ever seen in their lives." Well, obviously on December 7th, it was December 8th in the Philippines. And with the Army Air Corps neatly lining up all their aircraft on Clark Field, a majority of them were destroyed, including the airplanes Gene flew. When 100,000 Japanese soldiers invaded the Philippines, Gene and the survivors retreated back into the jungles and tried to make a stand, but it was futile.
I couldn't imagine the kind of fighting they had to do, you know, there for a few days.
Yeah, just inch by inch and truly a savage bit of combat there. So, Jim, from there, as the war is heating up, what was Major Carpenter, Charlie Carpenter's path into service? Where did he start?
Well, he had to report to a duty station in central Illinois, thinking he was going to be joining an artillery unit, because that's pretty much what his commission as a second lieutenant was allotted. But they said, "No, because you're a teacher, we're going to send you to a very hospitable place in the country to teach officers, new officers, how to be officers." So they sent them to Miami Beach.
And as I understand the story, Jim, if he had wanted to, we can never know for sure, but he probably could have held that position either throughout the war or maybe similar positions. He could have stayed out of harm's way. He was a bit older. He was very well educated. He had this opportunity to serve in a fairly low risk way. Is that true?
That's very true, especially with the letters home from Major Carpenter. But in the letters, it was the exact opposite what you're thinking. Although true, he could have stayed, he couldn't bear to see, knowing that his brother was either fighting in the jungles or captured, he couldn't bear to witness, as he witnessed firsthand, the sinking of freighters off the coast of Florida. He would see Navy and Army aircraft flying over Miami Beach, heading outward, looking for German U-boats that were prowling right off our shores. And he could see freighters on fire in the Atlantic. And that bothered him. He did complain several times to his commanding officers and stated, I want to go do something else. And they said, but this is important for the war effort here, teaching officers. Charles Carpenter was not that person to ever sit on the sidelines. He was a starting running back in football, starting guard in basketball, set track records. So he had competition in his blood, and he was not one to be a third string officer sitting on the sidelines.
So what was his first step then? What was his first move to sort of get away from the arguably more cushy job and start working his way toward serving in action?
Well, probably his persistence in bothering his commanding officers. and they said, well, the only thing we have open is being a glider pilot. And he said, fine, I'll take it. Before the war, he was learning how to fly. He was a ground school instructor. So he was enamored with aviation. I mean, like many young men of that late 20s, early 30s. I mean, that truly was the golden age of aviation. I mean, with Lindbergh crossing the Atlantic and all speed records being set, he followed that. And aviation obviously was a passion. So he went the glider route and went to bases in Texas, Tennessee, South Carolina. But the glider route, that funnel was being very, very clogged. It was filled, and by the time he got in his slot to actually earn his glider wings, probably would have been another 8 months. And again, he was not one to sit still.
So, how does the transition happen to L-birds from gliders?
So ironically, he was looking at his bulletin board at his glider base, and he saw a posting, I think it was 12 slots, for a new program called Liaison Pilot. Well, he didn't know what a Liaison Pilot was. No one really knew. It was a new creation, in a sense, for the Army Air Force now. On a whim, he signed up for it, not knowing what he was going to be thrown into, but he knew he couldn't sit around and wait for a glider. So he, was eventually sent to a place called Fort Sill, Oklahoma. Unique history on that, after Geronimo's capture, he was stationed at that prison where he eventually passed away, early on. It was also a training base in World War I for Curtis Jennings. So it had some aviation history, but the Army decided to start a liaison flying service utilizing basically former civilian aircraft. Piper Cubs were now known as L-4s. A Ronca 65 TCs or TLs were known as L3s, and Taylor craft were now known as L2s. And these aircraft were used, all tandem seating, were used to train military pilots how to work in concert with artillery units, how to spot enemy units from the air, and then also help direct that artillery fire. But it was, I think, Chris, you had mentioned it before. Basically, they became bush pilots. They were trained how to land in very, very rough terrain, fly underneath or over 50-foot barriers without touching the rope strung between the two poles, and landing on roads that were not straight, and there were no runways. This was brutal training, but this is what they trained for, because this is how combat was going to be.
You know, in some ways, it was almost like the foundation of what would become like the forward air controllers in Vietnam. Sort of the same sort of premise, you know, general aviation aircraft mainly flying in combat. I mean, that's incredible. And the training, you know, I think when you're training up and you're going to fly like a P-47 Thunderbolt or something like that, you're feeling like, well, there's some armor plating and things like that. I'm going to be in combat, but at least I have some protection, or there's big heavy iron. And now you're going to go into combat, but you're going to be in a cub. With extra windows, you know, I mean, that's
exactly,
that's a brave person to strap that on. I mean, that's incredible.
Well, and Jim, when you've recounted this story before, and we could talk about it now, you know, the L-Birds initially, once deployed over in Europe, had a little bit of protection to them in the fact that the enemy was frightened to give away their position, because you knew if you shot an L-Bird, what would happen.
Yes. Yeah, so shooting at an L-Bird was early on during World War II. The Germans knew that you do not expose your positions. Don't draw attention to these little green aircraft who, you know, later earned the nickname grasshoppers. Don't expose that, because they will rain down terror more so than a complete box of B-17 bombers. But the liaison pilots also had their own worries of, we have people that are going to be shooting at us. It's a 700 to 800 pound tube and fabric aircraft. We have no armor. In a sense, yes, bullets would go right through the fabric. That's a good thing. But bullets also go through bodies, and that's a bad thing. So there was a lot of concern on the L-Bird pilots, and Charles Carpenter, you know, eventually when he arrived overseas, thought about that long and hard, and he and a couple other pilots decided to make a change.
And that change really is what brings us to the story, and is what got the attention. Although, as we have all found from hearing your talks and from reading the book, there was a lot more to it than that. But instead of me teasing the audience, would you explain what that big change was?
So again, they eventually complete their training at Fort Sill. He's assigned to the 4th Armored Division, which is attached to the 3rd Army, which is General Patton's army. They eventually arrive in England in 1944, January of 1944, where they begin their training for the inevitable invasion of Europe and France, specifically. While in England, they sit around, like most pilots do when they're not flying, and discuss their options and how we can help shorten this war and how we can protect ourselves. So someone came up with the brainiac idea of attaching a bazooka to the strut of a L-4 Piper Cub. You know, there's a lot of aerodynamic issues that they worried about. There's the center of gravity weight issue they're worried about. But, you know, there's a live rocket sitting in a tube on your strut. Is that going to blow off our tail when we light that off? And, you know, someone had to go test that. So someone probably drank too much the night before and drew the short straw. And I say that tongue in cheek. But eventually they did. They went up and they used black electrical tape to attach a wire to the bazooka tube, and went up to altitude. There was an old abandoned British tank in this training grounds in England, and they dove on it and fired, probably closed his eyes. thinking that was the last thing he's ever going to remember. And lo and behold, there was no sound. There was just this poof, a little trail of smoke, and then an explosion inside the tank. Lo and behold, it worked. And, I mean, you think about it. As a kid, if you attach a straw to your bike and you're pedaling, that air is going right through that straw. It's not causing any issues. And that's what an empty bazooka tube did. So if one bazooka works, why don't we attach two? Unless you're Charles Carpenter and you say, if two work, why not six?
Because more is always better. Now, a quick sideline here. With the Elbird pilots at Fort Sill, were they training, say, in an L4 or you know, L2, L3 from the get-go, or would they have already gone through sort of the traditional pilot training path with a PT-17 or PT-19? And would they have done any of that, or would they have started from the beginning in the Elbirds?
Well, as a glider pilot, he did get steerman time, PT-17 okay. time. And then in gliders, they would use primarily Aranca L3s and Piper L4s. And they would take the students up to altitude, probably 3,000 feet, and they'd kill the engine.
Wow.
I mean, this was not a low throttle setting. They right. would turn the engine off. They were literally gliders. And that's how they trained. So he was, his next stage in glider training would have been the large Waco gliders that we see used during D-Day and then other sure. other missions during the war. So he had a lot of what I call seat of the pants flying and understood what these aircraft were capable of. Or so he thought. He just had to push harder in liaison training at Fort Sill. But again, in Fort Sill, L3s, L4s, L5s, and then he's assigned a L4 in England that was built by the Piper Aircraft Company in April of 1944. And in honor of the women that he met in California during his training, Rosie the Riveters, he was so impressed with the woman's role during the war effort. Because think about it, all these men are drafted or go into service or volunteer and are gone. So many of them, a majority of them, picked up the pieces to become security, taxi drivers, delivering milk, delivering the mail, building tanks, warships, aircraft, you know, farming. It's endless. The women in this country did so much to keep this country going.
Hear, hear. The reason for my questioning about sort of Carpenter's path in particular and types he would have flown is that he would never have gotten to any point in the training where they might be doing any sort of even rudimentary sort of gunnery practice or anything like that. Is that correct? Or would he have been exposed to anything like that?
As far as an actual gun on his aircraft?
Or even some of the theory of it, just thinking about going through the PT series and stuff like that, and then being diverted first to gliders, then to the L4s. I guess where I'm going with this is that this isn't somebody who's he's not obviously not a fighter pilot. He's not a ground attack pilot. Did he have anything in his background other than sort of the willingness to give it a try and the ingenuity to help him with things like how do you sight? How do you shoot from an airplane? How do you do any of that kind of stuff?
All my research indicates that this was trial by fire, and literally trial by fire. Right. This was, let's see if this works. We've got endless amounts of bazookas. We've got L4s. We've proven that we're not blowing our tails off. So now let's go figure it out. And you know, it's a great question because they had to figure it out. He and another pilot by the last name Pearson who only carried two bazookas, but is also credited with destroying some German armor. They sat around and put pen to paper and figured out what is the best route to take. Now, you have to remember, any tank is heavily armored, especially in the front. So a soldier on the ground is very difficult to attack a tank from a frontal attack. But the German tanks had a couple of weaknesses, and that was rear armor was thinner, and so was top armor. Well, Carpenter had elevation on his side. So they decided that they would need to dive from altitude, from 1,500 to 2,000 feet, and they would need to get, they had two areas of attack. If they're going to do an assault from above, they would need to get within 100, ideally 75 yards, and then launch it towards the top of the tank. Or they would come in literally at treetop level and try to get behind the German armor and then fire to the rear.
Just absolutely, absolutely staggering. And there's so many examples throughout Carpenter's story where he has just steadfastly, as you pointed out earlier, he doesn't take the easy way out. He doesn't, he runs toward the danger. And probably wouldn't have described it that way himself. He just, as you said, he did what he needed to do sort of time and time again. But he could have had this career over in Europe, flying the Elbird, sort of relying on that, at least early on, that kind of fear that the enemy had over harassing these airplanes. It could have been just fine, but that wasn't enough. And it's such an impactful story because of that.
Well, ironically, you mentioned he runs towards the danger. That's what got him in trouble. And that was on August 1st, 1944. They had landed the 4th Armored, had eventually made it across in July of 44, the Channel. And on August 1st, Carpenter was scouting via a Jeep landing areas because, this is a very, very fluid battle. This is... Patton is blitzing across France, and the Germans are in retreat. And he is chasing them day and night. There is no rest, obviously. And Carpenter is looking for a new landing field, finds one with cows grazing in the field, which means there's no mines, otherwise there'd be a bunch of dead cows, and these cows were alive. So he decides he's going to pick that, but he also notices a tank, an American tank, stalled near a town, which he had flown over earlier. And he goes up to the tank crew and asks, what's going on? What's the problem? And finds that they're worried about going into this town because they see German soldiers. There's some German 88s positioned there. And their fear is that the town is heavily defended. Carpenter decides to jump up on the turret of this tank, charge the 50, and say, let's go. They make a head run into the town with a Elbird pilot in the turret leading the charge, and they start encountering German resistance, which was lighter than what the tank crew thought. But still, there was resistance, and they were able to clear the town, and the Germans continued to retreat. Well, they're hooting and hollering and cheering, and the commander of that tank unit comes upon them and asks what's going on, what happened, and they point to the guy with the .45 strapped shoulder holster, his leather jacket with an Elbird wings on it, and they said, that guy's the one who needs all the credit. Well, instead, that commander had him arrested, and he was thrown in the brig, and he actually thought his career in the military was over, that he would if he ever went back home to Illinois, he'd be labeled a bum. He had shamed the Carpenter name in his mind, and he thought all was done, except it was the exact opposite. His general, General John Shirley Wood, heard about it, rescued him, and that ignited a huge fire in Carpenter's belly, and he became a one-man wrecking crew.
So, Jim, Major Carpenter went on to some great success with this idea of putting the bazookas on the airplane. He's credited with destroying multiple bits of multiple instances of enemy armor. He was a sort of small slice of his story became pretty popular. He'd show up in Stars and Stripes and hometown papers, and there's even the comic strip that sort of details his exploits. As we're coming up against the clock here, I want to let everybody know that, in my opinion, and Jim, let me know if you disagree. With the end of the war, he faced some personal challenges, some health challenges, but really his story was just beginning at that point. There was a lot more to his story after World War II. And I'm saying that to say that we probably don't have a lot of time to go through that post-war piece of it, but it's a great opportunity to remind everybody that they can watch your talk online, and they absolutely should buy the book and give it a read, because to me, it only gets more and more interesting from there.
Oh, I think we've only scratched the surface on Major Charles Carpenter, and you're absolutely correct. There is so much more. And the fact of there's really two stories within this story, and there's the hidden gem of Rosie the Rocketeer being rediscovered, which I like to equate as, in 2019, the last American World War II veteran returned home.
Wow, that's really remarkable. And that airplane, that L-4, it was in a museum in Europe. Is that correct?
Correct. It had been disposed of after the war. No one thought that would be possible. Only for the fact that Cub's lifespan in World War II was about 400 hours, and it was, after the war had ended, a Austrian glider club bought it, converted it into a glider tower, and put a 90-horse engine on it, and used it quite successfully for a long time, repainted it, but it still retained the battle damage and data plates. And eventually, Rob Collings found out about this aircraft and wanted a original World War II combat-proven aircraft of the European theater, and this one fit the bill. And Rob acquired it, and it was eventually shipped to Colin Powers out in Oregon, who's restored many other beautiful L-4s. And they found the battle damage that was described by Carpenter, which you can read in the book. And it was proven that this was Rosie the Rocketeer, along with the original data plates still attached. And Rosie made its first flight again back in 2020, and it proudly resides in the Collings Foundation Museum out in Stowe, Massachusetts.
It's such a remarkable thing, as you said, that there are two stories here, and the way both of them sort of come full circle. Now, Jim, as we're getting closer to the end here, you worked with Major Carpenter's daughter, Carol, quite a bit on this, and she provided you with the letters and things which you used to great effect in the book, really letting Major Carpenter tell as much of his own story as he can. She was able to reunite with the airplane through you. And her daughter, Charlie's granddaughter, played a small but key part in that restoration. Can you talk about that for just a second?
Yes, Carol's daughter, Erin, was born 2 years late to meet her grandfather, Charles. Charles had passed away in March of 1966 due to complications from Hodgkin's disease, which he was first found out about in February of 1945. But Erin was a painter by trade, and she reapplied her grandfather's nose art to Rosie, and just did an immaculate, beautiful job on that.
Could you imagine being a part of that, being a part of painting your grandfather's artwork back on his actual airplane from World War II? I mean, that's, oh my God, how special that had to be for not just her, but the whole family.
Right. And the fact that she happened to have that talent and skill.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing to say, oh, I went and sort of ceremonially pulled a rivet on a restoration or something, which would be wonderful in and of itself. But the fact that she was able to do that. Jim, where can the people listening to this buy your books?
Well, go to our EAA website, shop EAA. Mm-hmm. You can also buy it on Amazon, or come to AirVenture and buy a copy here, and I'll sign it for you if I'm here.
That's fantastic. All right. Well, Jim, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. As we alluded to, just a couple of days before we recorded this, Jim made an appearance with Chris on stage at our museum speaker series. And that talk was recorded and should be available online here shortly for EAA members. So you can go a little bit deeper there. But at the end of the day, if this story has captured your interest at all, and I don't see how it couldn't have, you owe it to yourself to buy and read the book. And by all means, please leave reviews as well. And speaking of reviews, thanks to all of you who take the time to leave reviews for this podcast on iTunes or Google Play or Stitcher or any of the other places you get your podcast. That means a lot to us, and it is the reason that we're able to continue on and keep producing these episodes. So with our thanks to everyone out there for listening, thanks again to Jim for taking his time today, and we look forward to catching up to you next time when you're cleared to land on the Green Dot.